You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a bill making its way through the legislature would change the way cooperatives in Wisconsin can choose to be structured. We'll hear arguments for and against those changes.
First, news about years of alleged serial harassment and assault from Hollywood mega producer Harvey Weinstein is renewing a national conversation about sexual harassment and abuse and what that culture feels like for women.
And our next guest says there are things men, even men who don't commit acts of sexual harassment and sexual assault, can do about it.
Cliff Leek joins us now. He's an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Northern Colorado and the president of the American Men's Studies Association. Cliff, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Cliff, we've seen allegations of sexual assault and admissions of assault before. We've seen cases against people like Bill Cosby, Woody Allen, Gian Gomeshi, Roger Ailes. Why is this story about Harvey Weinstein breaking through and creating a big moment to talk about sexual harassment and abuse?
Well, I think there's a lot of different pieces that lead to this particular story breaking through a bit. But I think to take a step back, I think it's important to focus on the first thing you said there, which is that this isn't a new thing, right? This isn't special, right? We have case after case after case of high-profile men having allegations of sexual assault, right? So I think rather than focusing on what makes this case special, I think it's more important for us to really recognize and think about the fact that why haven't all of the other cases been special? Like why haven't all these other cases gathered as much attention? And I think part of the answer to your question, though, of why this one is so special or why this one's gathering so much media attention, I think part of that is tied to sort of our political environment right now, in that we have the president of the United States right now is one of the high-profile men that has been who has been accused of multiple acts of sexual violence. So I think just that being sort of the setting of our political environment makes all of these conversations far more salient for everyone.
And we've seen some actors, some writers who worked in Hollywood coming forward, responding to this story, saying that they're appalled. Sometimes they say they're sorry. They wish they could have done something. Is that enough?
No, it's definitely not. And one of those examples that's been in the news a lot the last couple of days is Ben Affleck, for instance, who's made a big statement about how sexual violence and sexual harassment is absolutely unacceptable in Hollywood, right? But at the same time, he led the campaigns for his younger brother, Casey Affleck, who's also had multiple allegations against him. He's led campaigns for him to receive major awards in Hollywood, and he has no comment on that when that comes up. So simply apologizing and saying this is unacceptable isn't enough if we as men aren't willing to actually do something about it, especially when it's being perpetrated by the people that are closest to us.
I think if we look at the conversation going on now about what happened, is that it's taken the conversation out of Hollywood and saying this happens all over the place, probably every state, in places of high power and places that you wouldn't think of as having an obvious problem. It's widespread, much more than we think, and it's created this moment for women to come forward, some men coming forward as well. What do you think this moment and its potential has for us right now?
Well, I think the sort of the biggest example of this trend that you're talking about right now is the Me Too campaign. So it's been all over Twitter, all over Facebook, hashtag Me Too, or just putting Me Too on people's Facebook pages. And the idea of the Me Too campaign is that if we get every woman who's ever been on the receiving end, being victimized by sexual violence or sexual harassment, to say Me Too on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, that it'll really draw attention to the scale of this problem, right? And I think that there have been some good things that have come out of the Me Too campaign, but there's also some things about it that I find a little bit unsettling. And most of what I find unsettling is men's response to it. So a lot of men are coming out and saying, oh my gosh, I didn't realize the scope of this was so large. I didn't realize it was affecting the people closest to me. And the reason why I find that unsettling is because I find it hard to believe. If we don't realize that this is happening to the people closest to us, or we don't realize that it's that there's a tremendous scale to this problem, that's a willful ignorance. Because we've had a discussion about sexual violence in this country for decades now. So to pretend that we don't know that it's a major problem is, I would say, a willful ignorance. It's a choice not to know and not to recognize the problem.
So how do you reverse that if that's the case, and you're making the case that men on some level are choosing to either lie to themselves or to look the other way and not go any further with that line of thought? What can they do? What needs to happen?
Well, there are a few reasons why I think that men are sort of making this choice to not acknowledge the scale of this problem. Part of it is that, as I mentioned with this case of Ben and Casey Affleck, for instance, is that oftentimes we have perpetrators in our own lives that we know are perpetrators, that we know are folks that are engaged in sexual assault or sexual harassment on a day-to-day basis. And oftentimes they're the people that are very, very close to us. They're our brothers, they're our cousins, they're our best friends, our fraternity brothers, whatever the case may be. And if we recognize and acknowledge the scale of this problem, it means we have to make some really, really tough decisions about our personal relationships with people we care about, right? We have to make decisions about whether we're going to confront these men in our lives that are doing these things. So that's sort of part one of why I think so many men choose denial on this. The other piece of why I think we choose denial is that it also implicates ourselves. Like we, so many men, including myself, have parts of our own history, whether it was, you know, when we were in high school or college, where or even later in life, where we engaged in behavior that was sexually harassing or sexually assaultive, and we have to deal with that in our own histories and confront that. And figure out ways to move forward and make change. So recognizing the scope of this problem results in men having to really confront a lot of things about their own lives.
So how do you do that? I mean, I can understand what you're saying, that men need to confront those unpleasant parts of their own past and maybe their own ways of thinking, but what does that mean in real life to actually do that? What kind of steps that are concrete can men take?
Yeah, so we've seen some men stepping forward and trying to make some concrete steps in sort of the wake of the Weinstein scandal and in the wake of the Me Too campaign. There have been a couple sort of parallel campaigns to Me Too that have come out afterwards. So we have some folks starting a hashtag I will. So this idea that men should step forward and say what they intend to change about themselves. So that's one example. And there's also a, you know, hashtag how I will change, which is asking men to get really specific about it. And I think that's what we need is not just men to express sort of platitudes of, you know, I will think more carefully about this or I will be introspective, but to get more concrete about like, okay, so what actually are the things that we are going to do? And some of those things that we can get concrete about is, you know, we can commit to actually interrupting problematic behaviors that we see amongst our male peers and male family and things like that. We can also commit to trying to change our own attitudes and behaviors. We can commit to changing how we respond to women when they come forward. So instead of doubting every allegation that is made, maybe we can change to beginning to, you know, listen to and believe women when they come forward and make these allegations.
So because you're painting a picture of something that seems to me like a mind shift for some men in the way that they respond, let's walk it through. So what happens? You're a man and you see a situation where a woman is being made to feel uncomfortable. Maybe you see sexual harassment happening. What do you do? What do you say?
Well, I mean, it entirely depends on the situation, of course. But there are a lot of programs around the country now that work to actually train men on how to, you know, run through practice scenarios so we can practice our intervention skills, right? An example of that is Men Can Stop Rape based in D.C. So it's hard for me to answer a kind of hypothetical scenario, but we can actually do our own homework and prepare to, you know, be ready to intervene in these situations.
And as part of it, seeing examples of that in the media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So we are much more likely to see examples of men laughing and nodding along and joking along with sexual violence in the media than we are to see men interrupting sexual violence in the media.
Talking to Cliff Leek right now, an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Northern Colorado and the president of the American Men's Studies Association. And we're talking about what men who don't engage in sexual harassment or assault can do and what responsibilities they may have.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see men do to help stop sexual harassment and assault? If you're a man, have you ever been in this situation where you spoke up to a friend, a family member, or maybe let it go? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Cliff Leek stays with us now. He's an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Northern Colorado and the president of the American Men's Studies Association. We're talking about what men can do to change a culture of sexual harassment.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What should be, do you think, the role of men in stopping sexual harassment and sexual assault? How does this work in your family, in your workplace? If you're a woman, what do you want to see from the men in your family, in your workplace? What would you want to hear from them? If you're a man, what have you done? What have you thought about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Jenna with us from Milwaukee. Jenna, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Happy to be on.
Great.
Oh, so my statement that I just wanted to invite into the conversation is that every one of us, I believe, holds these kind of unconscious beliefs within us that women are objects or that sexual assault is normal or that even objectification of women and sexualization of women is sort of normal. I would like to invite that in addition to, like, the more active roles of, like, calling people out when they're behaving in these ways, we really look at the ways that our own thoughts and our own actions within our families and with our children and our, you know, lovers and all of that, the way we are continuing to perpetuate that culture and how we can shift that within ourselves and then out into the world from there.
Jenna, thank you. Appreciate that call. And Jenna saying some of what you also were echoing earlier, Cliff, talking about looking at the way that we think about things and whether or not we can shift those patterns within our own circles and within our own minds.
Absolutely. And what she was just saying echoes a lot of the social science research on the perpetration of sexual violence and sexual harassment. There's a lot of data that shows correlations between the perpetration of harassment and sexual violence, the correlation between that and our beliefs about women, whether those are conscious or unconscious beliefs about the status of women in society and our entitlement to women's bodies and things like that.
Jenna, thank you for that call. And Cliff, in the last several years, we've seen increased attention paid to the problem of sexual assault on college campuses and young men. What can you point to when it comes to how, as a society and within families, boys are getting raised, turning into young men, and what patterns might need to be interrupted?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up, because I think that that's something that I sort of skipped over earlier when we were talking about what can men do. I think one of the most important things we can do is to have open and honest conversations with our sons about sexual violence and sexual harassment. It's pretty easy for us to imagine mothers having conversations with their daughters about these issues, but it's incredibly difficult for us to imagine men having conversations with their sons about how important and how big of an issue sexual harassment and sexual violence is, and that's a problem. If this is such a huge societal problem, we need to be having those conversations with our sons. We need to be having conversations about not only respecting women, but treating women as people. It's even when we have men who do speak up about sexual violence, it's too often that we speak up by saying, you know, as a husband or as a brother or as a father, it's always, you know, I care about sexual violence because it impacts a woman that is related to me in some way, rather than I care because women are people, right? It's beyond just I care because I'm tangentially hurt through my relationship with women. And it needs to be about, this is important because women are people, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we've seen that pushback against that kind of engagement from men recently. I'm thinking more during the Harvey Weinstein story than before, and that this argument is evolving, that it used to be maybe more acceptable to say, as the father of daughters, fill in the blank here. Do you think that that's something that the message is changing and that it's getting through?
I don't know that it's a message that's changing, but I think you're right when you say that it's a message that's getting through. Because not just on this issue, but everything that I've said here today is things that women in the sexual violence prevention movement have been saying for decades. It's just a matter of, are we finally ready to listen? Both as a society and men specifically, are we finally ready to listen to women who have been saying these things for so long?
Why do you think women haven't always been listened to?
Well, I think part of that comes back to exactly what our other caller a moment ago was saying, which is, you know, if we don't see women as people and instead see women as objects, then we have less interest in listening to what they have to say. Even just thinking of, you know, traditionally the relationship between fathers and daughters isn't necessarily one of, well, I'm going to listen to and respect what my daughter says. It's my daughter's going to obey me and respect me, right? So we have a very long history of not treating women's voices as the voices as equal voices in society.
Talking to Cliff Leek right now from the American Men's Studies Association, where he is the president. He's also an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Northern California, talking about what men can do to change a culture of sexual assault and harassment. And you can join us at 800-642-1234. Have you had one of these conversations with your son and talk to them about what it means not to be a part of that culture, to interrupt, to do things that a bystander can do to intervene? And what about the culture at large? What do you want to see change as we have this conversation? And we go now to Thorne, who's joining us in Three Lakes. Thorne, hi.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
One issue that I wanted to raise was broadening looking at sexual harassment as not just being an issue between about male-bodied people perpetrating against female-bodied people. I think that is what gets more focused on. I personally see this as a symptom rather than a disease. We tend to look at sexual harassment as a disease, whereas I think it's a symptom of a greater cultural woundedness that affects men just as much as women. A man who is perpetuating sexual harassment behaviors is having a block in empathy, and that is the result of a wound. He's not able to see this person and be fully present with this person, and therefore he's perpetuating this behavior. Maybe he's trying to get his own needs met. And I see that as the result of a lot of disconnection in our culture, in our communities, disconnection from our land bases and the natural world. And I also see that as also stemming and related to cultural legacies of being descended from either oppressors or the oppressed, and the cultural wounds that we carry with us generations later.
Thorne, thank you so much for that. Appreciate those thoughts. And what about seeing this as an empathy block, Cliff?
Yeah, I mean, there's a great documentary about masculinity called The Empathy Gap, right? And the major argument of the film is that we do have in our society a generation or multiple generations even of men who are lacking in empathy, in part because of how we are raised to shut that off, in part because of, you know, how we understand what it means to be a man and what it means to be masculine is disconnected from any notion of being able to feel and express feelings, right? I think the caller was right in that we definitely should be thinking about the connections between these notions of masculinity that are detached from feelings to the ways that we perpetrate sexual violence and sexual harassment as well. Absolutely.
Thorne, thank you so much for that call. And we go next to Chris joining us in Green Bay. Chris, hi.
Hi there. You know, I remember way back in the 70s, my dad gave me this talk when I was in middle school. And it was quite simple and quite short. It was, son, you will always use appropriate manners, respect, and protect women. Is that pass muster? I mean, it works well for me. I've always believed it.
Chris, thanks for that. What do you think, Cliff?
I mean, I think that's definitely a fantastic start, and I think that's a conversation that a lot of men are not having with their fathers specifically. But I also think that that it is just that. It's a start. I think we need to have more of a conversation than that, especially because the sort of discourse of simply respecting women is very much tied up into sort of notions of chivalry, which have historically thought of women as property that is to be respected, right? So we can respect things that we don't think of as people, right? And I don't mean to imply to this caller and to this caller's father that that was the intent. That's not my implication at all. But I do think that that's part of the reason why that conversation, in my mind, isn't enough. We need to go beyond that and have serious conversations specifically about what sexual violence is, what sexual harassment is, why they happen, and what we can do about it.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for that call. And Cliff, thanks to you for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Cliff Leek, an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Northern Colorado and the president of the American Men's Studies Association, joining us there to talk about what men can do to change a culture of sexual assaults and harassment. Now, a new bipartisan bill is making its way through the Wisconsin legislature that would change some of the ways that cooperatives in the state do business and structure themselves. Some groups, like the Wisconsin Farmers Union, are opposed to parts of the bill and say that the essential nature of cooperatives could be affected.
We'll hear from an opponent in just a bit, but first, Scott Herrick is an attorney in private practice in Madison. His practice includes advising cooperatives of various kinds and assisting in the organizing of new cooperatives. He served on an informal work group that reviewed the state's cooperative statute, Chapter 185, and he testified in favor of this bill. Scott, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into this possible change in rules for co-ops, can you tell us what kind of co-ops are we talking about? What are they? What do they do in Wisconsin?
Well, the co-op statute in Wisconsin, Chapter 185, is a very broad general statute. It provides for cooperatives, which is a form of corporation. Mm-hmm. And the statute itself is no more specific about what a co-op would do than any other corporate law is. The general corporate law, a corporation can do anything that's legal. A cooperative can do just about anything that's legal, with a few exceptions that aren't relevant here. For example, credit unions have their own statute. But a cooperative can do just about anything that's legal. It's a question of the financial structure and the internal structure of the entity. So co-ops are one way of organizing businesses. Most co-ops in Wisconsin probably are farm-related, but many co-ops in Wisconsin do other things. Housing co-ops, for example. Many people are familiar with grocery co-ops. And in fact, I have clients that do all sorts of things organized as a cooperative.
And you were part of a recent working group that reviewed these state statutes that govern cooperatives. What led to that review?
Well, folks who deal with co-ops, who operate co-ops, try to stay up to date. So every generation or so, they take a look at the statute. As it happens, I was involved. I'm just old enough to have been involved 30 plus years ago when there was another look at the statute to just kind of upgrade it, that was implemented in 1984 or so. And then now, again, folks have said, well, we'd like to do this or we'd like to tweak that part of the statute. And so the cooperative network, which is a kind of general association that has many different kinds of co-ops as its members, convened an informal working group to take up those inquiries and questions and suggestions and put together those ideas, which in turn went to the legislature. So the bills that are now being worked on reflect specific issues or questions or requests from existing cooperatives.
So what would change under this legislation in the Assembly and then a companion bill in the Senate?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's not a lot of changes or upgrades, if you will, in the bills. The single largest one is not controversial at all, has elicited no opposition that I'm aware of, and that would authorize Wisconsin electric cooperatives to make a certain kind of member loan, that is, loans to its customers, its members, for purposes of energy efficiency. For technical reasons, those co-ops can't make those loans now. The other changes involve some what I regard, what the committee regarded as kind of housekeeping details about member access to the past year's records, financial records of a co-op, and probably the two points that elicited a significant amount of concern. One would allow a co-op to, through its own mechanisms, to have a small number, up to 20% of voting power, of what are called outside directors. Current law requires all directors of a cooperative to be members of the co-op. And several folks said, well, sometimes we'd like to have some outside people for various reasons on the board. We don't want them to control the board. We'd like to be able to elect outside directors. And so the bills would allow that to happen if the bylaws provide it. And then another point of some controversy, current law limits the dividends that a co-op can pay on stock to 8%. Now, in fact, most co-ops don't pay dividends at all because that's not the way a co-op is intended to run. Cooperatives, by definition, are not dividend-paying organizations. They tend to distribute their surplus, as we call it, through patronage rebates to the members or patrons. But the law does allow for dividends if they choose to do so, and currently restricts those dividends to 8%. The committee agreed with concerns that came to at the working group that 8% limit doesn't really function for anything these days. It has a historic roots, but it doesn't have any current function in our view. So it just eliminates that cap on dividends. And then one final change would allow a certain kind of co-op, of which I believe there's only one in the state, maybe only one in the country, but it's called a cooperative holding company. And the change would allow a cooperative holding company to amend its organizational documents so that it could distribute distribute voting power based on its patronage rather than simply on the one member, one vote principle. And I think that authorization, that possibility is the single point that elicited the most vehement or emotional or deeply felt opposition from folks generally, because they say a co-op always has meant and always must mean one member, one vote, no exceptions. And this would authorize a change in that aspect of the statute. So that is a basis of some opposition to the bills as they now stand.
We're talking to attorney Scott Herrick about proposed changes to the statutes that regulate cooperatives here in Wisconsin. And Scott, as you mentioned, that the one member, one vote issue is one that's gotten the most emotional reaction. And again, you say it applies only to one organization in the state. Is this an organization that involves a lot of different co-ops as subgroups or as members of this overarching group?
Well, you know, I'm not intimately familiar with the organization, but the general answer to your question is yes. It's CRI, Cooperative Resources, that's an organization that has grown over many years, has deep roots, historic roots in Wisconsin in the co-op community, and has grown and become very complex through mergers and acquisitions. And CRI is the only cooperative holding company in Wisconsin that is it's a co-op that owns and controls subsidiary cooperatives. It was the first in the country, and I think maybe still the only one, but in any case, it's the only one in Wisconsin. The general principle applies even to CRI in terms of these statutory modifications. The statute does not change the way that CRI is organized. The statute allows CRI to change the way that it is organized if it chooses to. It doesn't give it a different voting system. It authorizes CRI through member voting to adjust its member voting system to give some weight to patronage instead of simple membership. So just like really everything else in the bill, even this provision, this most controversial provision, is a, well, I've characterized it as a tool rather than a mandate.
We'll be talking to an opponent of this in just a few moments. I think the fundamental concern about those two changes, the voting membership, the one group, one vote, and the outside directors being on a board, some people in the cooperative field see that as against the spirit of cooperatives. What would you say to that?
Well, people have expressed those views with deeply felt emotion, which I have to respect. But I have to also say that as an attorney, I look at Chapter 185 as a way to organize the finances and governance of a legal entity. To be honest, I don't get very emotional about Chapter 185. And I say that as an attorney who has devoted a substantial part of my practice and my life to organizing and representing Chapter 185 cooperatives. And there aren't a lot of attorneys who have done as much co-op work as I have. But I still look at it as an instrument. And I think that the economy and the way we do business generally in the world and in Wisconsin has changed over the 100-plus years that we've had cooperatives. Wisconsin is certainly a cooperative model. I respect but simply do not share the emotional tie to the word cooperative. It's up to the legislators to decide what we can do and still call ourselves a cooperative. The word co-op is controlled legally, and you can't use it in the name of an entity unless you're in Chapter 185 or a related chapter, 193, for special purposes. What can we do and still be called a cooperative? How can we organize ourselves and still be entitled to use that wonderful word? Well, it's up to the legislature to say. I personally think that time has marched on. The economy has marched on. CRI, as an example, has marched on. Every time I organize a new cooperative, people ask me, well, we'd like to put some people on the board who aren't members. Can we do that? And I say, no, you can't. And they live with that, and that's fine. But every once in a while, there's a co-op that would like to be able to have an outside eye on the organization from the position of being a real, actual director. In the outside of the co-op movement, that's extremely common. In fact, it's often required, often thought of as a desirable and, in fact, mandatory thing. No outside directors? That's outrageous. You've got to have some outside directors on the board. Co-ops can't have outside directors. I don't think it's a spiritual question to say that co-ops ought to be able to have an outside director or two as a minority vote on the board. It's reasonable, in my mind, to put up to the will of the membership of the co-op and still be a co-op. I feel the same way about whether a cooperative holding company should be able to adjust the way that it determines its own voting power. It would be the members of the co-op that would make that decision. And I think they ought to be able to make that decision and still be call themselves co-ops. And I'll say one last thing about this. As a matter of fact, I would say, and I've said in testimony and to people involved, just about everything we're talking about doing with these bills could be done under the current rules with a little careful legal drafting. We already provide ways for voting to not simply be one member, one vote, for example. In summary, I see it as a toolbox that we can put a few more tools in. If the legislature decides not to put those tools in the toolbox, life will go on.
Scott, thanks for joining us today. Scott Herrick is an attorney in private practice in Madison, whose practice includes advising cooperatives of various kinds and assisting the organizing of new co-ops. He served on the informal work groups that reviewed the state's cooperative statute, and he testified in favor of this current bill before the Assembly and Senate.
Next, we hear from an opponent of the bill. Stay with us here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're looking at a bill moving through the Wisconsin legislature that would change how cooperatives in the state are able to structure themselves and how they do business.
We just heard from attorney Scott Herrick, who was part of the working group that reviewed this Chapter 185 of the Wisconsin statutes that affects cooperatives. And he testified in favor of this current proposal. Joining us now in the studio is Kara O'Connor. She's Government Relations Director for the Wisconsin Farmers Union, which opposes many of the changes in this bill. Carol, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we heard kind of a recap of what this legislation would do and kind of the case for why this might be useful. What are your concerns at the Wisconsin Farmers Union about the changes that would happen?
Let me start by saying there is one part of the bill that we think is fantastic. That is the part that would allow electric cooperatives to grant loans to members to do energy efficiency projects. Because of a technicality, they're not able to do that now. We think it would be great if they were able to do that in the future. Unfortunately, that part of the bill got tacked on with some other pieces that are a horse of a different color, and a big concern to our members and should be a concern to any member of a cooperative in the state. The changes would allow cooperatives to have up to 2 or up to 20% of the board comprised of non-members, and those outside board members would have a vote, including votes on what happens with the equity that cooperative members have invested. Cooperatives would be allowed to change their bylaws in ways that would advantage or give greater returns on outside investments compared to returns to members on their equity. And finally, the bill would greatly restrict members' access to records of the cooperative. Now, as a cooperative is a unique kind of business entity where the members own the business. And we think it's really obstruction of the nature of a cooperative to say that the owners of the business do not have access to the records of the cooperative.
And we've heard there are a lot of different kinds of cooperatives in Wisconsin. With Wisconsin Farmers Union, how big a role do cooperatives play for farmers here in the state?
Obviously, our members are primarily farmers and rural residents, and cooperatives are an integral part of the rural economy. It's important to note that cooperatives usually exist where there's a gap in the market that another business hasn't stepped up to fill. So, for example, rural telephone cooperatives emerged because the large telecom companies weren't interested in investing in rural areas. But there were people who wanted telephone service. They banded together. They invested in a cooperative. And those cooperatives are still operating and very successful today. And so in rural economies, you have dairy cooperatives that pool and sell farmers' milk. You have supply cooperatives where farmers buy together in bulk and get the advantage of that. Any number of cooperatives, fuel. We even had a member who said, I bought my bedroom furniture from a cooperative. And it's not uncommon for our members in rural areas to be members of 5, 6, 7 cooperatives.
What is your concern about the possibility of having outsiders on the boards of cooperatives? We heard the case that, hey, maybe this is somebody who brings a unique expertise, even though they're not a direct member of the cooperative. This could be that outside perspective could be a benefit.
It is absolutely the case that cooperative boards need outside advice. And I would say it's almost universal for cooperatives of any size in the state that they do have outside advisors, someone to give them advice on marketing trends, a particular area of their business like animal genetics that the members of the board might not already have. But the critical difference is that those advisors don't have a vote on the board. They give advice, they are looked to for their expertise, but the co-op members that are representing their fellow members of the board take that advice and make the decisions in the best interest of the members. That's the critical difference. And so we absolutely support and encourage cooperatives to have advisors. Some people call them ex officio board members, non-voting board members. Absolutely. But where we draw the line is giving those outside advisors a vote.
This legislation wouldn't, as I understand it, force a cooperative to have outside board members. The cooperative members would vote to decide if they want to allow this. So this doesn't, nobody could opt in. Would it be okay if an individual co-op decided, hey, we would benefit from this?
You know, that's an argument that we've heard over and over in this discussion. The supporters of the bill have repeated again and again, well, this is optional, not mandatory. And well, it's technically true that no cooperative would be forced to make these changes. Let's be honest. You don't go ask for an act of the legislature without intending to use it. The cooperatives that have advocated for these changes the most adamantly have already decided that they want to make these changes and have testified in public to the advantages of them. Unfortunately, they didn't take the time or the effort to ask their members first. And so we've had the really troubling picture in the legislative hearings of cooperative board members testifying in favor of the bill and their very own members testifying against it. And that doesn't bode well for the fidelity of those cooperatives that have signaled an interest in this bill to the democratic cooperative process. You have some co-ops that would never think of making these changes because they're so anti-democratic. And you have other cooperatives that have already decided without asking their members that they want to. That's troubling.
Talking to Kara O'Connor from the Wisconsin Farmers Union about proposed changes. They're in the state legislature now to the way cooperatives are governed and structured here in Wisconsin. There's also this this change that would apply to just one cooperative group, sort of a super co-op that consists of sub-co-ops. Gets a bit complicated, but the change would be to allow, I guess, bigger stakeholders a bigger vote, a bigger voice in decisions. Is that part of this that you're opposed to as well?
That's a big concern. You know, as a lobbyist, I read a lot of pieces of legislation, and it's always a red flag when there is a bill that would give rights to one business entity that are prohibited to everyone else in the state. And that's what's happening with this portion of the bill that would relate to a cooperative holding company. There's only one of those in the state. It's Cooperative Resources International. And I am not sure why that particular cooperative is finding the provisions of Wisconsin cooperative law so onerous to comply with when we have thousands of other cooperatives that are thriving under Wisconsin's cooperative statute. But I think it's fair to say that going and asking the legislature to change the law isn't the right approach.
Again, supporters of this proposed change say this gives co-ops flexibility. Again, nobody has to pick any of this up and run with it. Why is it bad to have co-ops have maybe a little more wiggle room in how they structure themselves?
I'll give you one example of why even a cooperative that wouldn't adopt these changes could be affected by them. That is the 8% cap on returns to capital investments. Right now, there's an 8% cap, and the way that that came to be was to make Wisconsin statutes in harmony with federal statutes that apply only to certain kinds of cooperatives, but they would still be subject to that 8% cap. There's good reason to have harmony between Wisconsin law and federal law. So if we would make this change, we'd have a split between those that are still governed by federal law and those that are governed by state law. And unfortunately, then co-ops would not be on an equal playing field. Even ones that didn't adopt these changes would be affected by potentially loss of capital.
Kara, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Kara O'Connor, Government Relations Director for the Wisconsin Farmers Union, talking about proposed changes to how Wisconsin cooperatives do business. These bills are in the Assembly and the Senate right now.